Thank you for coming, thank you for squeezing in. My name's Debbie Courtney, I'm a careers advisor here at the university and I look after creative careers and creative industries, so it's really great to see so many of you interested in exploring your option about getting into the sector. So, Michael, you're going to go first. I'll put your PowerPoint up.
Please don't fall asleep. I am number one, so hopefully you won't fall asleep. Thank you for coming. There's a very vicious rumour that public funding for arts and museums is being cut. It's so staggering to see so many people here today, I must say. But my name is Michael Stanley, Director of Modern Art Oxford, and I normally do this talk in about 40 minutes. I'm going to whiz through in 15. I think I can do it, and the reason I want to do it is because I want to show so much in terms of the breadth of what I do and where I've come from. I've actually focused so much on my early career because it's kind of the time where hopefully where you are now in a way. I always start my kind of slideshows with this one, a great piece by Robert Barry. During the exhibition, the gallery will be closed. It's a piece that he put on the door of a commercial gallery in Amsterdam in 1969. And when I was an art student here at the Ruskin School in the early 90s, Robert Barry was an artist who kind of meant quite a lot to me. But also the provocation of, if you're not looking for art in the gallery, where are you looking for it? And it's something which has inspired so much of my work and my approach to museums and galleries and where I am now. I also come back to this work as well, which is, again, I think important and has informed my approach to exhibition making. And it's an artwork that was made in a small northern town just outside of Liverpool, and it's the town's Christmas lights, which had been placed in the old market site, which was due for demolition and was about to be kind of destroyed. And the artist spent 3 days putting the lights together, rewiring them, and then with the use of a small like HSS generator got them going for about all of 30 seconds. This is all what remains of the artwork, and it's my last ever artwork as an artist, as it were. And I remember seeing this image and thinking, it's really beautiful, but what a bloody waste. Just that communion, I suppose, with me and this experience, and that was it. And I think from that moment, I always had this real dilemma about the making of an artwork and what it meant to have that triangular relationship between an artwork, place, and artist. And it's something which has infused so much of what I do. So I'm always eternally surprised that I've ever ended up in museums and galleries at all, because my interest in work and artwork particularly is work that exists outside in different situations and contexts. This is the first show I ever did, which is my old school. And with a whole host of artists lodged in the northwest, which is just outside of Liverpool. And you'll see there's a kind of a fitting thing that comes through so many of the projects. This is the school which was actually again due for demolition, so I kind of brought in a whole host of artists to make work in response to the site. This is the incredible Linda Sterling, who in the past had photographed Morrissey time and time again. And she'd done this beautiful piece where she filled the whole classroom with 80 tonnes of rock salt. And the reason I show this is just one of those cases where you insert art into people's everyday lives and they don't necessarily welcome it, let's say. So the whole piece, the whole actually exhibition was destroyed within 3 days, which is quite incredible. I remember the moment when I called Linda to tell her that her piece had been vandalised and Angela had got in and wreaked havoc. And she came down and she said, well, it's simple, isn't it? You just take the end A off. And it becomes Angel. It's a piece, you know, that's kind of so kind of imbued with a kind of pathos as well, and with all these things, so much of my work it was kind of destroyed. So I was kind of curious. My first kind of museum job was here at an incredible institution, which is the Harris Museum in Preston, up in the northwest, and it's one of those kind of incredible monuments to Victorian philanthropy as well. But even here, I was kind of really quite keen to rub up against that, I suppose, the hard-edged contemporary practice. This was a piece very early on in my career where I very nearly lost my job within like about 6 months. It was an artist called Keith Wilson, and the piece was called Puddle, as a public artwork. It's a kind of incredible, provocative piece, commissioned for the actual flag market outside of Preston. And I kind of nearly lost my job, because it was me who wrote the press release and said, council workmen will lift paving stones. This is when they think, you know, council tax has just been announced. And there's a huge kind of politicised sense in terms of what the council's spending money on. Which is, you know, reams and reams of kind of press articles. But so, again, so important for me in terms of gauging that relationship between the institution and the host. I'm going to whiz through these because I can't possibly do it. And come back to this piece. After the Harris Museum, which was kind of a publicly funded organisation, largely through the local authority, municipal in many ways, I actually did spend time in a wonderful museum called Compton Burney, which was owned and run by Peter Moore's Foundation. And then here, which is an icon gallery in Birmingham. So very quickly, it's a kind of a curious mix between municipal art gallery with a very strong Victorian legacy, if you like, contemporary philanthropy on that model with Peter Moores and a private foundation. And here, Icon Gallery in Birmingham, which, if you are familiar with it, you will know is a kind of a European Kunsthalle model. It doesn't have a collection, it receives temporary exhibitions, and its role is to promote international contemporary arts. And I kind of show this piece because, in a way, it's become quite symbolic of the way I think about museums and galleries and how I work within them. It's a piece called Pay Dirt by Joe Scanlon, and what appears as several mounds of compost is actually a lengthy process. This is actually about 6 tons of Starbucks coffee at the end of the day. And we spent 12 months working with the Botanical Gardens in Birmingham. And over a kind of an 8-month period, I literally sent the gallery attendants around Birmingham city centre to collect the spent coffee at the end of the day, which was then composted, turned into compost, and kind of processed within the gallery, and then spat back out, if you like, as product, as common. I've taken all that kind of very strong kind of Warholian ideas and concepts through, but seeing the gallery as this thing that would suck the world of outside inside, process it and convert it and kind of spit it back out again, if you like. And it became very, very clear that, you know, very, very strong, another artist or group of artists who became very, very important to me is John Latham and the Artist Placement Group, that Comtect is half of the work. And I'll talk just for the last kind of few minutes now on recent work and where I've come from. My first directorship was then actually in this quite remarkable place. For those who know this, this is the wonderful Milton Keynes. I'll say nothing. But there's three, you know, great images here of kind of, you know, mid-70s with this curious, like, Martian landscape. They're quite amazing, romantic and utopian images of what Milton Keynes was going to be and the reality. And taking that point, if you like, of context being very, very much half of the work, I mean, it's something which informs and fuels a lot of my approach to what running a gallery means. This is Michael Craig Martin and the first kind of piece of work I commissioned for the gallery when I was there, where we turned the whole gallery itself into a public artwork by turning the facade pink and a beautiful wall painting by Michael. And it kind of still goes back to what it meant to have a museum, but seeing a museum as a public artwork in itself that you could enter and engage with in the streetscape. And even here, engaging with place and situation. This is the Station Square in Milton Keynes, an exceptional artist called Wolfgang Violader. For those who know Milton Keynes, it's built on boulevards in this quite American-styled grid system. At the other end of the boulevard to the gallery, we commissioned Wolfgang, who rebuilt the gallery on a one-to-one scale. But the actual building was never fully finished. So he would build one elevation for the next elevation and the next elevation, and became this beautiful, like, choreographed building site that just was about expectation. So, you know, the kind of tens of thousands of commuters coming through the Station Square in the day expecting this building to be realised, and it never was. The actual artwork was this really stunning pinhole photograph of a building that was there and wasn't there, but over time and place, this very ghostly, eerie image. So that kind of relationship between the public space, architecture, the built environment, and how it informs approach to galleries and museums is still so key for me, I think so pertinent, because it maps so clearly what artists are doing and what contemporary artists are doing. And this is a fusion between Richard Woods, an artist who we worked with now in Oxford, and the architect Alex Dereika, who for the 40th anniversary of Milton Keynes, we built a tower. Milton Keynes doesn't have a tower, so it's a kind of the gallery's role to give it a tower. And that's also something which I think is really quite wonderful about the position or the work I do, that often it takes an artwork to make something happen, which should have happened a long time ago. But through all this time as well, the nature of exhibition making has become a real part and parcel of what I do, and been very fortunate to create a whole host of exhibitions with the Turner Prize winning artists. This is Phil Collins' incredible Smith's Karaoke, which you've seen at the Turner Prize. Really kind of moving moment with Anthony Wilson, who died a couple of years ago from Factory Records, and Phil, Roger Hyorns, Kathy Wilkes, that later was represented at the Turner Prize as well. This is all Milton Keynes, Gilberto Osorio, Marcel Broders. So quite an incredible stretch, if you like, of artists and artist representation within the model of the Kunsthalle. It's a white space. And seeing connections across from contemporary practice through to near historical to past has been so important. Just to conclude, this is James Lee Byers, and being, I suppose, as brave as to take an exhibition in, say, the rarefied spaces of Milton Keynes to the Venice Biennale. This is when we represented James Lee Byers then in a palazzo in Venice. Which really kind of says an awful lot, particularly about the international reach of so much of the work that we do, but also the international potential of so many these smaller kind of Kunsthalle venues across the UK and England. This is quite a gorgeous piece called Angel. This is Burano glass, and each sphere is the breath of one glass blower. I'm showing a lot of art because that's why I'm here, and that's what we do. To here, and this is a site that you'll know, the relatively recent Susan Phillips project, and kind of no mistake that really one of the launch of my program here was to make a first piece outside the gallery. This was the quite incredible Radcliffe Observatory, and Susan, who again then went on to be nominated for the Turner Prize this year. I don't know if anybody's seen this piece, but quite a beautiful sound piece in the Radcliffe Observatory that was fed from Museum of Modern Art, Oxford, in Pembroke Street, across the city via radio into this space. And thinking of space, one of my kind of keen interests, particularly with Modern Art, Oxford, and with any gallery or institution I've run, is that it's a place, and it's a place to be and to converse. And this is one of the early statements that we've done this year. With the Yard project, which is a ridiculously low budget to turn what was just our loading bay into a space where over the summer people have met, conversed, played music, sat, ate, drank, got very drunk, and lots of drinking going on, I'm sure. And but actually has put this quite wonderful and I think exciting frontage onto a street which otherwise wasn't there. So I've told you nothing about how to get into being a director of a contemporary art museum, but I hope I've told you everything about what inspires me and why I'm here. Thank you.
I haven't had anything like as colourful or interesting an approach to work in museums as Michael. In many ways, it's a rather more banal approach. However, my name's John Hobart. I work for the University Museums and have done for about the last 8 years. Unlike all of my colleagues behind me, I work in administration and management. Everybody behind me has more museum-specific skills or background, whereas I come from a more generalist background. Hopefully that will give you some ideas about other ways to approach and come into working in museums, be it university, local authority, independent, or whichever. my route very quickly. I'm a product of the system, I'm afraid. I was undergraduate and postgraduate here, Keeble and then St Hughes. I'm an Oxford boy. I was at school in Oxford. I live in Oxford. This is my home. I love it to bits, and I love everything about it. Even the people who are gowns, who are townies, not gownies, if I could get it the right way around. Completely tie my tongue up. I came into museums with an academic approach. I'm Arkanath undergrad, archaeology PhD, and initially worked in collections here in the Pitt Rivers on a basic collections-based project doing cataloguing. I was very fortunate. As part of that project, we got to be a little bit involved in education, and we got to work quite closely with the conservation team. We got to sort of dabble in bits of marketing and bits of interpretation. So I was extremely lucky that it gave me a very good broad base for understanding how museums work. However, I didn't take that forward very much, so I moved quickly into the management administration side, working initially for Michael Hannon, the director here at Pitt Rivers, who I still work for, but I work more broadly also with the Ashmolean, Pitt Rivers, Natural History and History of Science Museums, running the Renaissance funding stream and overseeing the projects which it funds. At a day-to-day level, that is basic management. It is, you know, processing, finance, budgets, administration, nothing that is what one would consider to be unique to museums. The advantage that I have working here is that having an academic background, you know, I have doctor in front of my name. There's a lot of people around Oxford with doctor in front of your name. It's not very impressive. But it does mean that if you go and talk to lecturers, curators, and the like, and they think you understand what they mean when they talk about the importance of research and teaching, and you know, you can get away with it a bit more. They understand that that you have a common language. It's an advantage here in the university sector. Outside the university sector, doesn't make too much difference. Lots of people who've got PhDs don't even mention the fact. You discover some time down the line that they're incredibly highly qualified and have brains the size of planets, and you hadn't quite realised. Not to worry. So, you've heard a little bit about independent museums from Michael. You're going to hear, I assume, more about university museums from Heather, Agnes and Andy. What that misses out is local authority museums. There are an awful lot of local authority museums. They were touched on by Michael. There's a museum of Oxford here, there's a museum in Woodstock that's the county museum. But as you go into the big municipal areas, all of the big municipal museums, so Birmingham Museum Galleries, Manchester City Art Gallery, Bristol Galleries, Portsmouth, Southampton, Hampshire, everywhere you go, you will find local authority museums. There are, this is the reality, I'm afraid, there are terrible funding cuts going on to museums. Museums are not statutory services, so councils see them as an easy way to save money. So they're looking at 30 to 40% savings over the next few years. That's an average, maybe. It's probably a worst-case scenario. Maybe they're 20% in some places. However, I don't want to say let that put you off thinking of museums as a career, but I would say think about how you approach it. There's a lot of different skills in museums. Some of them are very museum-specific. Others are not. For example, when the Ashmolean was recruiting its front of house team last year, they weren't so interested in people who had worked in museums, but were very interested in people who had customer service experience. This is something Gillian knows a great deal more about, sitting here in the front row. I just noticed. Damn, she led on it. I don't get it wrong, I'll be in trouble. It's thinking it laterally and about different ways to approach. What can you bring as an individual? What skills have you got that can come in? You can come into a museum and say, actually, I do offer something that all your regular applicants for jobs don't have. And we've got Caroline here as well, who runs the volunteer scheme for the university museums. There's a lot of people who volunteer in museums, and having volunteer experience is vitally important. It helps a huge amount to know what museums are like a bit from the inside as well as a visitor. But that said, if you want to end up in the way that where I am, in a sort of management administration position, then having finance, HR, customer service, marketing, all of those sorts of skills that you can gather in almost any field actually put you at an advantage. They don't have to be museum specific. Increasingly, and the art project is a great example of this. Museums are having to find ways of raising their own funding, raising their profile, you know, finding their own, you know, standing on their own two feet. To do that, museums are having to think more like businesses. As a business, you don't want to have people who just think like everybody else in the business. You want to have people who come in with new ideas, fresh approaches, come in from the outside and say, well, hold on, have you thought about doing it like this? It makes a massive difference to have a fresh perspective. And this is true in administration and management side, but it's also true in, I would argue, all aspects. Why you do see quite a lot of mobility between museums and the way people work. And just hearing Michael's career there, he's moved from in a range of different places, be it galleries more than museums. But everywhere you can come, you can have a fresh perspective. You know, his take on modern art Oxford is different from his predecessors. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, it makes organisations, you know, look for and employ people from outside their own area. So I would say, yes, it's worth getting volunteer experience in this museum and in these museums, but also think about how you can apply the skills you've got and volunteering beyond them. So there are other, you know, there are plenty of volunteer organisations around Oxford. Working in a different one, then bringing that to the university, bringing that to a local authority or an independent museum could be very advantageous. I've written down here, I've sort of slightly, well, immediately erred from my list of 5 points that I was going to make. I put down brutal truth that there are not many jobs. And that is true. There are not a huge number of jobs in museums. But we want people to apply. We want to be able to have the best people come into the sector. As you look around yourselves, the other brutal truth is it's somewhat female-dominated. Yeah, we were saying just between ourselves that this panel should really have half a man and 4.5 women on it, because that's probably more accurate. So this is a sector that has got a lot of women working in it, plus, minus, whatever, doesn't make any difference. But be aware of the sector that you're going to be working to. Be aware of the places that you'll be applying to. Just, you know, it's all about doing the research, finding out what there is. But it is, as I say, a brutal truth that there are not a huge number of jobs in museums. But we always want the best, so if you're one of the best, then apply. Experience is vital. Yeah, volunteers, range of venues and roles. Indirect skills, customer service, HR, finance, marketing, and especially independence. Those were all the key points that I wanted to get across. Probably haven't filled my... I had 10 minutes, I thought. I haven't filled my 15. I know there's going to be plenty of time for questions at the end, so anything that occurs to you, feel free to shout. Other than that, I will probably stop at that point before I completely run out of things to say. I could waffle for hours, but it would be a waste of your time and mine. That would be me.
I'm Heather Richardson, Head of Conservation. Firstly, what is conservation? Conservation can be defined as all actions aimed at the safeguarding of cultural property for the future. Its purpose is to study, record and retain the culturally significant qualities of the object with the least possible intervention. Who are conservators? Conservators work in museums and also in private practice. Conservators generally specialise in a particular field of conservation. Practising conservators have often retrained from other careers. I'll talk more about that later. And conservators generally have a balance of artistic and scientific skills. Conservation specialisms: paper and books, photographs, paintings, textiles, archaeology, conservation science, and then material specialists: metals, ceramics, stone, leather, organics, inorganics, and then objects, social history, ethnography. That's just some of the disciplines. Different training courses cover different specialisms, although generally most BA or BSc courses cover mixed materials, and MA and MSc level is generally more specialist. The size of the institution that you work in will have a bearing on the type of conservators on staff. In the large nationals, such as the British Museum, there are completely different conservation departments based on materials. conservators in the different departments may not have any knowledge of the other conservators that work at the British Museum. They might have maybe over 60 conservators working on staff at the BM. These conservators are more inclined to work within a fairly narrow idea of conservation, doing mostly what we would call interventive conservation work or bench work. Conservators in smaller institutions tend to be broader and work on a greater range of objects and materials. These conservators also tend to work more broadly across museum departments and with a wider job description. Many museums do not have on-staff conservators at all, but contract out individual conservation projects to private conservators. Conservation at the Pitt Rivers. We're three conservators, two full-time permanent posts and one full-time contract post. We're all ethnographic conservators, but with archaeological training as well. Ethnographic conservators work with a broad mix of materials, but in many ways have an even tighter code of ethics to work with than fine art conservators, out of respect for the cultures whose material we are working with. It is often the people and the cultures that draw conservators to work with ethnographic collections. Private conservators used for work, we use private conservators to work on photographs, manuscripts and works on paper. So a part of the code of ethics of being a conservator is you don't work on something where you do not feel you are competent to work. That's within your code of ethics. Conservators here work very closely with other departments, particularly the collections management and the technical services department, who in this institution do display work. But we do work across the board. So we regularly work with Andy, say, in education, and when John worked here, we worked with John. So the conservators in this institution are Kate Jackson, Jeremy Uden, and myself. I'm just going to talk you through their career paths as they moved into conservation to give you an idea of the kind of breadth of conservators. This is Kate. Kate has worked here as a conservator on contract since February 2008. She took her first degree in fine art, particularly photography, from 1998 to 2001. After working for several years in completely unrelated jobs, Kate decided to pursue an interest in museums by completing a BSc at Cardiff University called Conservation of Objects for Museums and Archaeology. She got it first in 2007. Kate took 3 years to do the degree as she was coming from an arts background and needed the full period of the course to learn the scientific aspects. Her knowledge of photography is a very useful skill in completing the levels of documentation necessary when conserving objects. Kate chose to specialise in ethnographic conservation due to an interest in other cultures. Here she is conserving a hide shirt collected in 1841 from the Blackfoot people of modern-day Alberta in Canada. Jeremy Uden has worked at the Pitt River since July 2008, having succeeded me as senior conservator. Jim originally did a BSc at Bristol in biology, but after graduating immediately started the same BSc in conservation as Kate at Cardiff. Unlike Kate, Jim did the course in 2 years as he had a first degree in a science subject. Although Jim has no qualifications in art, he is incredibly gifted at all crafts with a high degree of manual dexterity. Prior to working at the Pitt Rivers, in 1996-97, Jem was an intern in ethnographic conservation in Aberdeen under a training scheme run at that time by Historic Scotland during the 1990s. He then worked at the Horniman Museum in London, Auckland Museum in New Zealand, and the Royal Albert Memorial Museum in Exeter. All of these museums have very strong ethnographic collections. Here, Jem is conserving a Tahitian fowl or headdress, collected on Captain Cook's second voyage of the Pacific from 1772 to 75. This object was being prepared for an extensive loan to three European institutions. There are only two known examples of this object in the world, here and at the British Museum. I've written here, I am very old, John. I had a first career working in the theatre, which I went straight into after A-levels without doing a degree. I initially worked in lighting design and then moved into stage management, hence all the lighting business. firstly with props and then running shows. Having travelled extensively, I was interested in museums and objects from other cultures. I took this interest and started to look at what jobs use my interest and existing skills. I considered conservation and exhibition design, but decided to train in conservation as I felt I had better, I had good hand skills, but not enough creativity to be a designer. I did a BA in conservation and restoration at what is now the University of Lincoln, gaining a first in 1998. I undertook the same one-year internship as Jeremy in Aberdeen in 98-99, and then worked at the Royal Albert Memorial Museum in Exeter, the National Museum of the American Indian, Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., and the British Museum, before starting at the Pitt Rivers in 2001. This image is part of a source community project I've been involved with this year, where five hide shirts in the collection were taken back to Alberta on loan for a mix of handling workshops with Blackfoot community groups and exhibitions. At Pitt Rivers, we are doing a lot of work with source community groups at the moment. Conservation is a graduate profession, and you won't get any work as a conservator any longer without a recognised degree. This is a list of a few of the courses available in this country, all with their pros and cons, and certainly not an exhaustive list. Conservators need ideally to have a balance of art and science knowledge, good manual dexterity, colour recognition, problem-solving abilities, and spatial awareness. Too many people in this country are trained, and there are not enough jobs for them all, and those in work are generally poorly paid. So it's never going to be a get-rich-quick option, even if you manage to be in work. If you think you might like to try conservation before committing to retraining, there is an internship scheme run by the Institute of Conservation, which is my professional body, and funded by the HLF. They take on a mixture of new conservation graduates and people that are interested and just want to try it out. And they are paid internships for between 6 months and 2 years, but the competition is very fierce for those. And at the moment, it doesn't look like the funding will exist for those for very much longer. But you'd have to look into the press to find out that one. I think that's it.
Hi, wow, I'm kind of gobsmacked actually by the number of people here. Anyway, my name's Andy McClellan. I am Head of Education here at the Pitt Rivers. I'm going to say a little bit about what education is in museums, something about how I became an education officer, and also about how one can become an education officer, and something about training programmes that we will have shortly here in Oxford. Actually, I shall go to the first one. This is a picture of me in younger days.
The one on the right, the one on the left.
Thank you. And the other one now I think of as the Pitt Rivers Museum. Now, Heather's sitting there going, oh, my God, what's he talking about at this point? Because her... conservators and collections are often there to keep education on the straight and narrow about how we view and perhaps I should say support the way in which we see collections. What I really put this up for, and I kind of come back to how we all work together. The reason I put this up is this book was a really, really important book for me when I was a child. And when I look at that picture, it brings back all sorts of memories of imagination and places you can go and what it means to be a child and be creative. And working in museums, for me, creates all of these thoughts. So when I look at that and say, this is me and this is the Pitt Rivers Museum, I know what it means because I, like John, also grew up in this city and I can remember coming to this museum as a child. And to be working here now is a really amazing thing for me because it was one of the kind of formative experiences of my kind of childhood that gave me a love of museums and made me want to go into this as a profession. There's an element of luck that actually got me working here. The other reason that I put this as a picture on the board is that it will mean different things to you, and I know that to some of my colleagues in the museum, a picture like this might suggest that I see the rest of the world as a wild thing and me there as something sustainable, which I don't distort. It's just about my childhood memories. But it does say something about how we might understand learning in museums. And that's the main reason I put the picture there, is to start to explain what learning means. And if you do end up taking a part into education in museums, understanding what learning means and getting some kind of qualification and or experience of how that works is really, really important. This is the second picture that is going back to my childhood, because I owned a climbing frame. Well, I didn't own a climbing frame like this. My parents owned a climbing frame like this, I guess. I suppose, in the late 60s or early 70s, which is probably when this photo was taken, and I've got a really strong memory of climbing around in this climbing frame. But when I think of learning, I think learning is... this is how we learn. If you imagine each of those kind of nodules as a piece of information, you've got all these different ways of connecting the information together. And those bits of connection go in all sorts of directions. So when I learn something, I place it on my imaginary climbing frame, which is kind of somewhere in there. And when I place another piece of information, I connect that together. It's my kind of neural pathways or something like that. And we're all doing that. Now, when I get a bit of information about another culture or something that interests me, I'm placing it on my climbing frame of learning. And you're doing the same thing. And the chances are that you're placing your information in similar kinds of places because we are broadly similar, living in the same time period. We are probably coming from broadly similar backgrounds, but I can see that there are a lot of different people in here. There's a certain kind of intrinsic difference between me and most of the people in this room, which means that some of that understanding will be different. But what this means to me when I think about education is that although there are broadly similar ways in which we all learn, there are also very, very different ways in which we organise and understand information. And this is important in learning in all museums, but it's particularly important in teaching through a museum like the Pitt Rivers, and understanding that people come to the museum and interpret it in different ways. And our job as educators is to get an idea of how they learn and then to help them move towards a better understanding so that we get rid of some of the misconceptions about how understanding goes and build a kind of, I'm not quite sure what the word is actually, but a better understanding of the world around us. This is how you might put the same thing together if you're writing a book about the academic side of learning in museums. This is a picture from a book called The Educational Role of Museums, edited by Eileen Hooper-Greenhill, who used to run the Museum Studies course at Leicester University and is one of the main writers on education in museums in this country. And it shows four different ways of learning in museums. There is the traditional lecture and text way of learning. There's the kind of discovery learning of picking up, lifting flaps or pressing buttons. There's behaviourist learning. Actually, I'm never quite sure. Behaviourist learning is a real way of learning. Behaviourist learning, as I'm sure some of you, perhaps all of you know, is how you train a dog. You kind of, if it does something you don't like, you might hit it, for example. I'm not quite sure. I never have quite understood how this relates to museum learning, but apparently it does. And the other one is constructivism. Constructivism, which is something I've always been very interested in education, is how we take... construct our own knowledge, how we construct our own climbing frame inside us by basically constructing that knowledge, because there's no absolute truth in what that knowledge might mean. I'm not going to explain it very well. If you really want to understand that, there's a wonderful book called The Constructivist Museum by a man called George Hine, and he explains it much better than I can. But a museum like the Pitt Rivers, while it's organised as kind of traditional lecture and text, what we might call an organised museum, it really is an organised museum, stuff's out there organised into cases, when we go into it, we move from one side to the other and we get this kind of constructivist approach. Now, why am I saying all this? Well, it's very easy to go into museum education thinking that it's a stepping stone into being a curator or an exhibitions designer or a curator or the kind of real jobs in museums. But one of the things I try to say all the way along, and I'm very lucky in that most of the people I work with, in fact, perhaps all of the people I work with in the Pitt Rivers, agree that education is also a real job in museums, and it's not a stepping stone somewhere else. It is a stepping stone to being an educator in a museum. And if you want to follow that line, follow it. If you want to be a conservator, go and get your conservation. If you want to be an academic, if you want to be an academic curator, go and do your PhD and follow that line through. But if you want to get an idea of what education is and want to find out whether it works for you, there's a really, really easy way of doing that, and that's to talk to someone like Caroline, who's in the front row, who I'm sure will be standing up and saying something towards the end, and coming and volunteering for us. Because the only way to know whether it will really suit you is to come and volunteer and help out. And, of course, Caroline doesn't just organise volunteers for education. She also organises volunteers, to some extent, across other parts of the collections as well. Now, the kind of things we do, if you come and volunteer for us, or the kind of things you will do if you end up working in a museum, is doing all sorts of things where you create things for people to take away. This is a totem pole we have made in the past. Having now worked with collections and conservators on a source community project where we brought in a lot of Haida people who are the people who traditionally made totem poles, I probably now wouldn't make a totem pole like this, but I now have a better understanding of Haida culture. Although they had mixed feelings about whether we should or shouldn't, a totem pole is a reflection of your own family and your own past and your own history and the stories around your family, and that's kind of what we did. We got children picking animals that said something about who they were. We also do large drop-in events, so to be an education officer you need to be very well organised, you need good time management, you need good people management. These are real skills, but you can learn them on the job or you can learn them with help from other people. We give talks, so we stand up in front of large groups of people and talk. This is Chris Jarvis down at the bottom from the Natural History Museum wearing a fez, and that's me in the front row. I think I'm wearing a veil of some sort. We're talking about ancient Egypt. Chris and I often dress up when we get on stage. This one here, I think, if any of you have seen George McGavin out finding tigers in Bhutan as the chief scientist, this is George McGavin dressed up as a bit of dung, I think, talking to children. So George does a lot of different things and has a lot of different skills. We also, one of the very important things we do is thinking about the professionalism of museums and what museums really do. So a lot of what we're teaching about is physical learning in museums. Museum learning is very different from classroom teaching. In classrooms, you tend to use paper and computers and talking and things like that. And in museums, we really concentrate on physical learning, of getting people looking at things and smelling things and touching things and seeing what you can learn. We call it reading museum objects. There's an awful lot you can find out from picking something up and looking at it really closely. It tells you a lot about not just the object, but it begins to tell you about the people who made the object and the people who use the objects as well. These are some of our other events. Organising, maybe, I know it's a bit light, but I think it's quite nice. I prefer to be seen slightly, but these are Tibetan monks dancing in the bottom right-hand corner. So as well as coming into museum education, because museum education is the area you want to go into, how do you actually do that? My own background is in school teaching originally. I qualified as a secondary school history teacher nearly 20 years ago. My intention was to work in museums. At that time, there weren't really professional qualifications in museum teaching. If you went into museums, it very much was mainly primary school teachers taken out of schools and put in museums and trying to teach in the same way. That has changed, but I wanted to do that, so I wanted to work in museums, so I thought I needed a teaching qualification first. So I trained as a teacher and did a work placement. I did my teacher training in Nottingham, and I worked at the did one of my placements at the Nottingham Archives Office and got some experience developing teaching resources for them. I probably could have gone into museum education at that point, but I thought I should get my qualified teacher status, so I thought I'd go and work for a couple of years in schools, and actually found teaching is quite an interesting job to do. And I, as much as people say teaching is a terrible thing, I love teaching while I was doing it. One of the great things about teaching as well is that there are children everywhere. You can go anywhere you want and teach children. So I took my teaching qualification, and just like Heather took her conservation qualification around the world, I took my teaching qualification around the world and spent 6 years out of the country travelling. I left with no money. I travelled and worked and came back with quite a lot more money than I left with, so which is a really, I would really say that's a good way of travelling. When I got back to the UK, I had about 8 years of teaching experience, and I'd looked at people in schools who were going up. I kind of felt like I kind of knew what school teaching was about and needed something else. And I looked at people who were deputy heads or head teachers or heads of department, and they were either lazy and didn't do their job very well and looked like they were quite happy, or they were really, really stressed out and looked like they were going to kind of keel over and die tomorrow. And neither of those approaches really appealed to me. And I felt that I couldn't, you know, I didn't really see this middle way. Now, there are some people who manage to be heads of department and to be happy in life as well, but it really, I think that is really, really hard work. So I thought, what should I do? Well, I just came back to the country, I didn't have a job, so I thought I would retrain again, and I picked up this idea that I'd had at first of going into museum education, and I went to Leicester University and did a master's degree in museum studies, and I did that just about 10 years ago. And the first job I got was at the Pitt Rivers. I was fortunate enough that at that point, this was really just as museum education was beginning to professionalise itself, they had very little idea of what they needed in an education officer because they'd never had one before. So they hopefully didn't make the mistake of employing me in 2000 to be the first museum, to be the first education officer for the Pitt Rivers. And I had a rather stressful first couple of years where I was setting up all the programmes here. I had wonderful colleagues to work with at the other collections, particularly at that point because there weren't that many education officers at the Ashmolean. Two education officers there who really helped me out and gave me kind of structures to work around, and Janet, who is still working in the Natural History Museum. And that collaborative working has kept on going, and we are very lucky in Oxford that we have jobs that work across the university collections, and we very much see ourselves as one big team working together, and we can achieve a lot more working together than we can on our own. I think with that professionalisation, do you take the museum studies line of going and getting a museum studies MA, or do you go and take a teaching degree, or do you end up doing what I did and do both? On the whole, I wouldn't advise you to do both immediately, because it takes quite a long time to do that. What you need to do is choose which one you want. If you want to go into a museum and be a school's education officer, then the best thing to have is a teaching qualification, because you need the experience of being in a school and managing children and all those kind of things. So if that's the area you want to go for, if we are advertising for a primary education officer or a secondary education officer, then we are looking for people with teaching qualifications. If you want to be working with families or communities or a range of other areas that aren't directly with schools, and that's a lot of teaching in museums, then I would recommend going down a museum studies grade. And I think that's something that has really changed over the last 10 years. Increasingly, we're seeing our education officers having vocational museums qualifications, because actually what we want is not people who are just going to apply school teaching to museums. We want people with a real understanding of what learning from museum objects is, what learning theory in relation to museums is, and what, certainly for a museum like the Pitt Rivers, the basics of something like constructivist education theory or discovery learning, or whichever way you decide to take your learning. That's the route that I would recommend. Now, how do you do that? As John has said, it's increasingly hard to get jobs in museums, and people volunteer, and then they find that volunteering in a museum won't necessarily get them a job, or at least won't get a job in the Oxford University Museums and Collections. Now, on the whole, although this was my first museum job, on the whole, the Oxford University Collections aren't a place to get your first job. For most people, I think actually, as we've got two education officers here, I think that's untrue for both of us, isn't it, Caroline? But we are the exceptions that prove the rule. On the whole, it's better to go off and work in other museums if you really have your heart set on working in the Ashmolean Museum or the Museum of the History of Science or whatever. It's better off to go off and get other experience and then come back to those jobs once you have, really, as John said, once you have the skills that the museums are really looking for. The other thing is, volunteering doesn't necessarily tell a museum that you have the skills to be able to teach it. You can be a volunteer for a long time and you can do some really meaningful things, but on a CV, it's very hard for us to know whether that's real experience or how far you went or whether you really devised programmes. So although it can be great experience to get you started, the main reason for volunteering in a museum is to find out whether you want to do it, whether working in that kind of environment is actually something you really want to do, would do for a career. Because as has been said, or as Heather said, we museums are not famously well paid. We expect people with sometimes multiple levels of postgraduate qualifications to be paid a pre-undergraduate salary sometimes. It is worth it. Most of us working in museums believe that it really is worth it because we get a lot of job satisfaction out of what we do. So volunteer to find out if you want it, get the qualification that will get you into the area of museums that you want to work in, and then go and get some real experience somewhere, wherever it is, that will allow you to do the job that you want to do. So in the meantime, I was going to show you some of our resources. I think I'll go past those. One of the... What I was going to say is... a couple of the skills you need. This is one of the main projects that we do called Making Museums between the Natural History Museum and the Pitt Rivers, and it's all about digging up bodies and then following objects through all the processes they do in museums. This idea was a stolen idea. It originally came from Leicester University MA in Museum Studies, because at the end of the MA, they get people to go through all the different, or they used to get people to go through all the different processes. So you have to create a museum and show that you could do all the different things. And about 8 years ago, we decided to try and do that within these museums, but with 10-year-olds instead of with master's degree students. Once you've stolen your idea, and I think this kind of goes across the board in most educational things, because there is no real ownership in education, once you've stolen your idea, you need to get together with some really creative colleagues, because no good ideas come out from, I think, in education, from people working alone. They come out from collaborative effort. You then get together with some really creative colleagues, and you take that idea and turn it into something absolutely new, which is what I think has happened with this project. Once you've got your stolen idea and your collaborative colleagues and created this idea, you then need to get together with supportive colleagues within your museum, people like Heather and people like Collections, who then talk to all our kids as we go around, so that they can find out what really happens in museums. And if we are really successful in doing that, instead of having 100 of you in this room, we hopefully have 500 or 1,000. Whether it's a good idea to really encourage people to want to work in museums, I don't know, but maybe if we do, we'll have more chance of getting funding into the future for the jobs that we all want to do. And just showing a few of the things that we've done, I think I'll leave it there, actually, that it allows us to do things which get some recognition. And here's a few of our volunteers. So I'm sure Caroline will say something, but if you're interested in museums, come and volunteer for us and see where it goes from there. I shall stop there.
Hello, I'm Maggie Sandtick, and I'm certainly one of the odd one out. I'm not from Oxford. I've only moved to Oxford 2 years ago when I got the job as head of exhibitions at the Ashmolean. And if you remember, 2 years ago, the Ashmolean was a building site. The crane was not quite erected when I came, but it was erected pretty quickly, and there were no exhibitions. So it was an exciting time to come to Oxford, from my point of view. And I do cover another museum type, which John didn't mention, and that's the National Museums. I used to work at the National Galleries of Scotland, where I was organising the exhibitions there for nearly 8 years. So I've got a variety. But I thought I would focus on very much the practical side of things. And I did very standard, perhaps, for my generation and sex. Because I'm a girl, I did art history. But I combined it with Latin, because I liked Latin. That's irrelevant. That's relevant. So I did Latin, but that led me to other languages. The other reason why I'm the odd one out, I should have said that right away, is I'm a foreigner. I'm Austrian. So I studied art history in Austria, which is quite a different focus. It's very much more traditional. Contemporary art didn't really focus at the time I did it. And so I went to Paris to do that in Paris for a year, and I can only recommend that. Travelling is definitely good. But the other added advantage of this particular side of my studies was the added languages. And I know in England you tend to think English is just fine because everybody understands it. But if you want to do detailed negotiations or want to get your own way, then speaking the other language helps indefinitely. So if you're able to call up whoever it is in German or French, you will get an instant response rather than having to wait for a translator, and perhaps a month later you might get a negative response. I never waited for that. I started off after my studies as a museum educator, mainly because, for two reasons. I wanted to work in a museum. I didn't think it was a way into curatorship, but I wanted to understand why people wanted to go to museums. I personally enjoyed it, but, you know, that's my private entertainment, as it were. And it was extremely enlightening, because the first shock of my life was that not everybody knows who Cézanne is. The second shock of my life is even educated people don't know who Cézanne is, and they're not interested in him either. That was quite a grave mistake. The problem was, I was working at the time at the Belvedere, and all people wanted to see was Klimt Kiss, because that most people seem to have that in their bedrooms as a poster. I got bored with Klimt Kist after a while. But having said that, it was very useful from a practical point of view to understand where people were coming from. The most difficult age group I've ever worked with were the teenagers, late teenagers, who knew everything. And it was a pleasure to actually work with what everybody calls the senior citizens nowadays. But you get the breadth of who is actually coming, and I think that's an important factor from my point of view, is who is actually coming to the museums and who are we doing this for and why are we working there. Some of it is obviously the objects and the protection of them, but the other side is, you know, you don't need an educator if the objects can just linger in the showcase safely under dark cover, because that protects them from light. So in that respect, that was a very useful experience. I then became a curator, and you could have thought that was the dream of my dream job, but it wasn't. I was curator only very shortly, because it really wasn't where I was wanting to go. It was for various reasons. I was a junior curator, and what was useful was the breadth of what I had to do, started from spending nights at the printers to make sure the catalogue was printed correctly, to event bookings, because that's the way we had to do it at that museum, to taking VIPs or non-VIPs around the museums, as well as labour text, making sure that was accessible. But it wasn't my where I wanted to go. And the main reason was that it was focusing and narrowing my own horizon, if you want, to one specific area or specialty. And what I really enjoy in exhibitions is that, and especially at the Ashmolean, which is perhaps the widest possibility, is that one day I could be organising an exhibition at the moment about Egypt, and the next day it might be contemporary art. Not much, but a little. And that's the variety I enjoy, and that's why I really went into exhibitions. And to a certain extent, I covered that in Edinburgh as well. In terms of practical training, I did do a postgraduate museum studies course, but it was an applied one. It was very different to what the English system offers. It was, you had to be working in the museum already to do it, and it was a very much more practical side, and I have to be honest, I would recommend that sort of course, because it provided, for instance, a course about, a baseline course about tax law, very useful, accounting, even more useful, and very boring things also as to how to install a picture on a wall you have never met. You might think it's quite standard, but if you try and install, we were dragged to a castle in order to install pictures there, and you get all sorts of walls in the castle, so one might be lath and plaster, so the screw just falls through, and the others are perfectly strong plaster boards, so you have to use one type of screw, and then the rest one is brick, so that's the easy one. So it was a very hands-on course, and that, in terms of the volunteering, is certainly what you should try and get out of it. Postgraduate and what I do has a lot of connection, but nowadays a lot of my time is spent on budgets. So I'm sure that's the same thing. That seems to be just the course of life, not in a negative way. I'm not going to talk about budget cuts. But just the fact, I mean, I'm sure you've come across this in your daily life, you have to keep your money where you're going, and you have to keep focus on where you're going with it. This is obviously relevant if you're working in the public sector. I think accountability, the lovely 80s are long over. That's one side of it. The other side, as I say, it's beautiful to be able to deal with exhibitions of a great variety. Because it does mean that you have to read up on it, because I couldn't be standing here and just sort of waffle about something I have no idea about. And I don't know much about Egyptian mummies. So there is an opportunity to just learn a little bit more on every corner. But it's also the practical side, so I have to work with doc collections management systems to make sure that everything's logged, that we don't lose works of art. You might think that's not so difficult, but my worst nightmare exhibition, I have to say that, was a Lord Byron exhibition a few years ago, which travelled from the National Portrait Gallery in London then to Edinburgh. And it included, for some unknown reasons, the Victorian liked this, locks of hair. But of course, locks of hair in a paper envelope from 18 whatever, you open the envelope and the hair just goes. I'm glad to say I didn't lose Byron's lock of hair, but I had a nervous breakdown in the process not to lose it. Similarly, you might find, you know, beads is another favourite one. We had the Lost World exhibition early this year, so we had to do, I don't know whether any of you saw it, but it had necklaces with 3000 BC beads. And we had to count every single one of them. That's the non-glamorous side of conservation, because our conservators had to do that. But it's a great deal of pressure on making sure that you have all 264 or 581 beads still on the string attached. I'm sad that I didn't manage to get a PowerPoint together, but the images I would have shown you would have been more similar to one of Michael's images, namely the crane, dangling crates over a truck. Because that's the practical other side of it, transport and actually packing the objects safely. And that side of things, sometimes it could be considered a travel agent for artworks. It is not quite as bad as that, but it comes close on occasion. And finding solutions, that's really the main aspect probably of my job for the last 10 years overall. Finding a way when you think, oh no, there's no way we can get this in, or hang this upside down, and you just have to find a way of doing it. So I've had to unframe pictures on trucks, that was not very pleasant, or take off doorways or unhinge doorways. Mm-hmm. On occasion you just have to say no, it won't fit in, and that's just that. But generally there's usually a way and the means to get by. And that's really what I want to pass on to all of you, because there is a way in if you wanted it.